On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the old storybook tale, when little Heidi got sick, she went to the countryside to recover, sunshine and meadows. These days, life expectancies are stretching out longest in some of America's biggest cities. A recently born New Yorker can now expect to live 9 months longer than the average American. This hour On Point, suburbanites and country dwellers take note. The new buzz is of the urban health advantage. Joining me first today from New York is Clive Thompson. He's a writer for New York Magazine and author of this week's cover story, Why New Yorkers Last Longer. Clive, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
I've got to ask you right out of the gate, did the Chamber of Commerce get you to write this? Is this a big booster piece for the, you know, health spa that is New York?
Yeah, it's rare to be able to write, as a journalist, a straightforward good news story. So I sort of enjoyed this one. My little gift to the health department of New York City.
We'll set aside the booster charge for a second and judge it on the merits. What are the numbers that have people, or the trends that have people focus suddenly on New York as this, you know, sort of health machine?
Well, the big one is the overall average life expectancy, which has been increasing in New York and increasing faster than the rest of the country. Overall in the U.S., you add the average American lives about a month or two older every year. It goes up very slowly. New Yorkers used to live shorter lives on average than the average American.
Used to, as in how long ago?
This was in the 80s, 70s.
Okay.
And then in 1993, finally, New York caught up with the national average. It matched it. And ever since then, it has been pulling away, up higher. So life expectancy is growing more rapidly in New York than in America at large. Over the last, I think it's about 5 or 6 years, America put about 2 years onto the lifespan, life expectancy,
yeah,
and New Yorkers put about 6.2 years on. Okay. So you can see the disparity growing. It's growing rapidly.
You've got material in here from Chicago and Atlanta and Baltimore and Memphis and Pittsburgh, but let's just continue to look at the Big Apple for a second here. What happened? Is it just that you got rid of some of the scourges of New York, or that you've actually, you know, sort of added on the positive side to the healthiness of New Yorkers?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. The simplest way to raise the life expectancy of a city, because it's an average number. It's not about how long you're going to live or how long I'm going to live. It's about how long the average New Yorker lives. And what that means is, so, you know, say it's like 77 years, roughly, is the average New Yorker's life expectancy. Every time someone dies younger than 77 years, it drags the average downwards, right?
And if they die a lot younger, it drags it down more.
Exactly. It's simple math. So the best way to quickly raise your life expectancy of a city is to prevent as many people from dying young as possible, people dying in their 20s, 30s, or infants even. And that is precisely what New York did in the 90s. Because, you know, back in the – if you look back at the 80s and 90s, there's a lot of people dying, young people, dying from crime,
right.
Homicide.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people dying from AIDS. They were also very young people.
Mm-hmm.
There was a higher infant mortality rate, and those have a very – you know, as you pointed out, they really dragged the average downwards. Those are three areas that really revolutionized in the last 15 years. The homicide rate plunged from like 20 – it was 2,500 people dying from homicide. It's down to like 500 now.
Wow.
And AIDS went from around 4 – I think it was around 4,000 – down to over 1,000 now. The amount of child mortality rate went down very dramatically. These things had a very, very big effect.
So those big drags on life expectancy in the big city reduced, and therefore helping pump it up. You note that a New Yorker born in 2004 can expect to live 78.6 years, now 9 months longer than the average American will. There's the scourges. What about on the plus side? Leave aside homicide,
right,
and
right.
AIDS and
yeah,
infant mortality.
Yeah, sure.
Are there pluses that are working for city dwellers?
Yes, there are. Because one of the interesting things, homicide, AIDS, these are very classically New York ways to die. These are things that affect New York more than other parts of the country. But things like heart disease and cancer. Now, though, that's uniform across the country.
Everybody's again, vulnerable. Anybody can die of that. Yeah,
everybody's vulnerable. It's about how you know, there's some genetic factors, but it's also about how you lead your life, how much exercise you get, how much you weigh, these very basic things. And so the interesting thing is New York has also been really cleaning up its act very powerfully with those diseases. And that leads us to say, okay, so why is that? What is it about the city that makes you lead a slightly healthier life, potentially?
And please tell me. I mean, the first images for a lot of people that come to mind are high tension, high stress, streets jammed with, you know, automobile exhaust and taxis honking, and it hardly looks like a day spa.
No, I was terrified when I moved here. I mean, I moved to New York about 8 years ago. I grew up in Toronto, which is a very green, pretty, clean city. I rode my bike around all the time. I brought my bike down to New York. I took one look at the traffic. I gave it away. Right. I didn't. I was like, I am
get
not
thee from me.
Right. And so I thought, well, boy, my exercise rate is going to go down a lot because I'm not cycling. I'm going to lose years off my life. Well, that's not true, because one of the things that New York is very good at doing is it forces you to move around a lot. It's like an immense jungle gym, that you have to climb and clamber over every day. You're running up and down stairs in the subways. You have to walk everywhere. No one owns a car. No one drives a car here. So everything you do requires you to get up and move. And so New Yorkers essentially walk and move athletically a lot more than people in rural or suburban areas. And this turns out to have a very powerful effect on, you know, cardiovascular activity, health, weight. One study that Robert Frank, a guy up in British Columbia, he found that when he compared the body mass indexes of people in big cities versus people in rural and suburban areas, the average person, like someone like you or I, a guy like you or I, would weigh 10 pounds more living in a suburban or rural area versus living in a place like New York City.
Just because New Yorkers are charging up and down subway steps? What else is at work there?
Well, there's a bunch of things at work. There's a lot of exercise. And again, you have a lot of salutary things like parks, for example. There's tons and tons of parks in New York City, and they're all very nearby. They're only a couple blocks away.
Because of the density of population, people are likely to be close to one.
Yeah, and it turns out that, when the RAND Corporation studied park usage and found that, it's kind of what you'd expect, but the closer you are to a park, the much more dramatically likely you are to use it. So if you have to drive to get to your park, you're never going to use it. If it's two blocks away, you're going to use it all the time. And so there's another sort of sort of beneficial athletic effect. So you get that stuff too. But then there's even more subtle things, like the fact that community is highly indexed to quality of life and quality of health.
What do you mean by community?
Having a real network of people that you are like-minded, ethnic group, a community group, people that you have the same hobby.
Whether you're doing aerobics with them or not, just people that you feel friendly
exactly.
with, you're more likely to live longer if you've got that kind of
Because there's a lot of support effects. Maybe they're watching out for you. They're noticing if things are going awry with you. They're suggesting you get health care if they're seeing that you're sick or something like that. There's even just psychological advantages, quite frankly, to having a lot of people that you can, help unload on. So it turns out, in any densely packed area, you get a much higher network effect with community. And that is a very powerful effect, very subtle, but very powerful.
Now, what about simple things like health care?
Healthcare. Yeah, well, there's another thing. I mean, obviously, in a place like New York City, you've got 9 or 10 million people here, so it's a huge market, and a lot of wealthy people too. So it's a huge market for the first healthcare advances. They arrive here first. Now, at first, obviously, only the rich can pay for them, but you actually get a pretty quick trickle down in a place like New York City. There's a lot of the standard of care is higher in a place like New York City than in a lot of other areas. Now, I mentioned wealth, and here's another. Mm-hmm. This is a big thing, though. One of the really big things that there's no study that has tracked this, but every urban theorist I talked to said, look, one of the really big things that happened in New York in the 90s is that it became much richer. You got tons of this dot-com and Wall Street money pouring in here, and wealthier populations always live longer. They always live healthier. They're eating better food.
But all of New York, New York's a big place, a lot of boroughs, not everything is down on Wall Street or on the Upper East Side. I mean, you still got the Bronx and big stretches of Queens that aren't exactly, lux life.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And that's why we're talking about the average of New York City, but it gets really interesting, the wealth thing, when you look at the individual neighborhoods, the individual boroughs, right? Mm-hmm. Because I actually analyzed each borough by borough to see how they'd fared against the national average, and it's really interesting. Because if you went back 20 years ago and you looked at all the boroughs, they were all clustered two-thirds. If you were to rank all the townships that are roughly the same size in the U.S., mm-hmm. there's about 3,000 of them. And 20 years ago, New York was all the boroughs were two-thirds away, four-fifths away down the list. They're near the bottom. Mm. Over 20 years, Queens moved almost all the way to the top.
Wow.
Manhattan moved up to the top fifth. Brooklyn, which is a more working class neighborhood, mm-hmm. moved halfway up the rankings. Staten Island moved pretty far up. They're also in the top fifth. But the Bronx, the most economically recessed part of the New York environment here, actually slid downwards slightly over 20 years. So life expectancy there slightly went down. And again, it's indexed entirely to wealth. There has not been the boom passed the Bronx by.
We'll hear in a moment from Dr. Gary Small in Los Angeles. Let me take one call first. Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Alan.
How you doing? I just wanted to say I'm going to read the article shortly, but I was born and raised in New York in a walk-up like all of us. And what I have to say is the New Yorker takes the attitude of why walk up the stairs when you can run up the stairs?
Speed.
Yeah, exactly. And my dad's in Manhattan right now, still lives here. He's 82. He walks 5 miles a day. He's in great shape. I'm 6'2", 165 pounds. I live in Cambridge now, and I still hustle like I was in New York.
Pretty good body mass and hustle right at the heart of it. And
yeah,
exactly. Clive Thompson writing that is indeed a big piece of it. Let's go to L.A. as well for a minute here. And Dr. Gary Small, he's director of the UCLA Center on Aging, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA. Scientific American ranks him as one of the world's top 50 innovators in science and technology. He's author of The Longevity Bible, 8 Essential Strategies for Keeping Your Mind Sharp and Your Body Young. Dr. Gary Small, is one of those 8 moved to the city?
All I got to tell you, Tom and Clive, after reading your article, I'm moving to New York. Get a real estate agent for me right now.
Well, there's a lot of folks there already. Does this only apply to New York? Or when you're a demographic guy, look across the country. Can we generalize to American cities here? They have quite different profiles.
But, you know, I think some of what we're learning from this piece that Clive wrote and what we've learned from the scientific evidence is that it's not just New York. It's cities around the country. But the factors that contribute to healthy aging or successful longevity may not apply to all these cities. For example, yesterday in Los Angeles, I think I spent about 3.5 hours in my car.
So you're in a city, but the car seat is very familiar to your rear end.
Well, usually it's not, but yesterday was not a great walking day for me. And so that doesn't add to my longevity, that kind of experience. So if you have a city, a commuter-type city like Los Angeles, I would expect that you wouldn't have the kinds of longevity data that you see in New York City.
So does it have to be a vertical city for this to work, do you think, Gary Small?
There's lots of factors. I mean, also in Los Angeles, we have a lot of sunshine, so that tends to draw people outside. But the elements that tend to contribute to healthy aging are the ones you've been talking about. Physical exercise, having a social network for practical support. People can drive you to the hospital or recommend a physician, or the psychological benefit of having a network of family and friends nearby. Another thing is healthy diet. If you're in New York, there's lots of little grocery stores, fresh fruit and vegetables on the corners. In a lot of these suburbs and a lot of cities around the country, you're getting fast foods. And the studies tell us that just exercise and diet have a major impact on how well and how long we live.
Let's take a call from Williamsburg, Virginia. Flavia, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, he made my point. What I was going to say was that when you're living in a large city like that, you have more access to different types of food. And like he said, the fast food and the big franchises are pretty much what you get in suburbia and some of the rural places. But to get an Indian restaurant, a Mexican restaurant, to have access to more types and varieties of food on the healthy food end is much more accessible in a large city.
Flavia, let us pursue that. Clive, what about it? Paint a picture for us. I mean, is the New York food supply really so different from the rest of the country, from exurbia?
Well, you know, That's a really good question. I mean, I would say definitely a big city like New York is always going to be on the cutting edge of healthy food for one reason. It's a very tightly concentrated market, so it's very easy for people that want to offer healthy food to go there first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you got 9 or 10 million people all living in a few square miles. You know, you don't have to reach it over a big area. So you get a lot of healthy trends that hit a place like New York first. Now they do actually filter out. I travel the country a lot for work, and it's interesting noticing how much like organic food and stuff has really just spread all over the place. But it definitely hit a place like New York first. So you'll see those trends first. You mentioned the outdoor sort of the ubiquity of green markets and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting too. Because some studies have found that if you take even this even has an impact on poor communities. Like if you take a look at teenagers, a study I read that was about teenagers that found that poor teenagers in a rural or suburban area versus one in the city area, the kids in the city area were eating more leafy green vegetables, even though you're talking about the exact same income level, right?
Wow.
So it's not that one of them had more money than the other, the family had more money than the other. They just had the ability to easily access them, because in a lot of poor communities, the options simply aren't even there. And in fact, that's actually, I walk around the Bronx, and there's very, very hard to get a good crisp vegetable there.
Let's take another call. This from the Bronx in New York. Claudia, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'd like to just weigh in on a conversation. I know that you did say that the Bronx is sort of an enigma because it has flipped. And I was just curious to know if the study was done on just particular pockets of the Bronx, neighborhoods like Marsania, Moss Haven, in the South Bronx. Because I live in Co-op City, and I think that the seniors here particularly show a great resilience. They move around very quickly. They're very frightened. My mom and my dad are in their 80s, and when we had a blackout, they walked up 18 flights of stairs, and these are double floors.
Excellent.
To each stair. So I don't know where they're getting their information from, but I happen to believe that the Bronx has a lot of hidden mysteries about it that people have not uncovered. I live 5 minutes from the beach. We have more parks than any other borough in the city, and it is often being used by seniors as well as young people.
And what about less advantaged residents of the Bronx or elsewhere, Claudia? Do you think they really get to share in the health boom Clive is talking about?
I think they do. I happen to have gone to a recent hospital, Lincoln Hospital, just to do some quick intake. I think I was just doing some follow-up with for myself. And I saw more people there using the facilities. I saw a lot of young people. I saw a lot of people who just appear to be in much better health than one would expect. So I think we have the services, and I think the people are being taught how to use them better. And I just think that we need to revisit the study, because I really think that the Bronx has gotten a black eye for far too long.
Claudia, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Hey, Clive, the Bronx is raising its flag there and saying, lay off. We climb our stairs, too.
Well, look, the Bronx is a really enormous city, right?
Sure.
So there's definitely going to be neighborhoods that absolutely fit the profile this woman's talking about. I have absolutely no doubt. I mean, I'm talking in a very rough way about the overall average of the Bronx, which is, where life expectancy has gone down. And I mean, definitely the reporting I did up there, I was visiting with some doctors, St. Barnabas Hospital, the biggest acute care facility. And, I was just getting it directly from their mouths. They're like, look, one of the single biggest problems we have is that the vast majority of our patients are overweight, to the point where it sort of becomes a cultural shift. It becomes difficult. This is what the doctors are telling me. Their patients will come in, they got a perfectly normal weight kid, a healthy kid, and they go, he's not big enough. Because
this is
all
the cultural
them,
norm thing. When your peers are big, you tend to get big too.
Yeah, exactly. And it looks weird to be – when you look skinny, you look a little scrawny and unhealthy. So the parents are genuinely worried that their kid is unhealthy, because he seems too skinny. So there's – I mean, and again, a lot of the stuff, a lot of it has to do with income, with education. I talked to – the smartest thing I heard in all this was really interesting. Nicholas Freudenberg, he's a professor here, urban theorist at Hunter College.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, I said, so, what do you think, if there are one or two policies that you think would have the most effect on a place like the Bronx or any poor community to increase life expectancy, increase health, what is it? He said education. Because if you can get high school graduation rates up, college rates up, education has a very strong correlation with longer life and with healthier living for a bunch of reasons, among the fact that you also wind up making more money in life, but you also understand more about health. And I think he's completely right about that. And New York has pretty abysmal high school graduation rates. So I think it was a very smart point he made.
I want to look more at this issue of income, but age comes in here quickly, too. Gary Small in Los Angeles, we hear a lot these days about more retirees moving to cities. Now, one question that raises, I mean, first of all, you know, is that good for their health? But also, does that on its own sort of bump up life expectancy in cities? Because if they're retirees, they've already made it to a certain age. If they've got the money to move to the city, they've got a certain kind of income. Is that skewing the life expectancy numbers in cities' favor, Dr. Small?
Well, yes, it is skewing it, but I think it's also helping others. There's a trickle-down effect. So when you have higher-income people, you have educated people, they're going to affect people nearby. And if you're in an urban center, the likelihood of there being interactions within these groups and among these groups will increase. You know, another important factor is mental stimulation. And we know that keeping our minds active, constantly learning new things is tremendously important. You take a place like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, where there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of culture, a lot of discussion and reading and interaction. That's going to help educational experiences. It's going to help expand our minds. It's going to reduce stress and have another effect on life expectancy.
Of course, Clive, you've got a lot of book clubs in the suburbs and farm towns as well, as far as that goes. I mean, it's not as though people who don't live in cities aren't thinking.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like a lot of these effects, you can break out any one of these effects we're talking about, the reasons why this happens, and you can see a lot of them happen, you know, in suburban areas, in exurban areas, in rural areas. Essentially, what you get kind of a positive network effect when you get all these things happening at once in a place like New York. That's probably what a lot of the urban health experts were telling me, is that, you know, you can't point at any one of these. It's just a lot of them that all impact on each other in a positive way. So you could definitely go to a different part of the country and find some of these things happening, but it's that wonderful sort of brew of all them happening at once in a tightly packed place like New York that seems to be having an effect. And there's another thing that's different about New York, though. Here's an interesting point, is that you have millions of people all living in one place, and it's very easy, if you're on the public policy level, if you're the health commissioner, to do one thing that affects all their health, you know, because they're not spread out all over a long place. An example, a couple of years ago, Thomas Friedman, the new health commissioner, he came in, he said, okay, I want people to stop smoking, so I'm going to put a new tax on cigarettes.
So active steps, one.
And then he goes, now we're going to make it so you can't smoke in bars. Mm-hmm. Now, can you imagine that in New York City? But he got it through.
Right.
And sure enough, they saw a very quick, sharp drop off in smoking. Because of the scale of it. You got, you know, millions of people here. This affects a lot of people. So the fact that everyone's clustered in one place, you can really target the population.
And then last year, the ban on trans fats. That's a big deal, too, in restaurants.
Yep. Yeah, ban on trans fats, and also a labeling mechanism, that regulation they put through that is requiring pretty much most fast food restaurants to label the calories on their foods, you know? So all these things, you know.
And, of course, just today, the move toward reducing traffic in Manhattan by
congestion pricing, yeah.
Yeah, but putting a price on driving there, I guess that will drive even more people to mass transit.
Exactly.
To foot.
So, you know, if you live in a community where people are really spread out amongst a bunch of different municipalities that don't agree on what direction to go, it's very hard to affect a lot of people all at once. But in a tightly packed city, you can sort of just with one stroke of the pen, you know, put a policy in place. People may not like it, but they'll get used to it, and it's healthy for them.
Let's look beyond New York a little more here. Eleanor Simoncic joins us from Baltimore. She's an epidemiologist at the National Institute on Aging, an associate professor of geriatric medicine and gerontology at Johns Hopkins. She's conducted studies on age and walking in Baltimore, Memphis, and Pittsburgh. Eleanor, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to participate.
So what do cities do for us, particularly as we age?
Well, they can do a couple of good things and a couple of bad things.
Okay.
As Clive's article points out, that New York is one city in particular that is very supportive of walking and almost forces a particular pace, a walking pace, that is protective of health. But urban areas can also be blighted and can make walking difficult and almost dangerous in some instances. So we've done studies in Baltimore in particular where we've looked at walking behavior in older women and found that many do continue walking despite difficulty, but their neighborhood has a lot to do with whether they continue walking or not.
Right. Now, one interesting piece of that, you mentioned it was pace itself. People do a lot of walking all over this country, but that hustle factor, that New York tempo of life gets people, and maybe in other cities as well, just walking faster in order to stay with the flow, and that feeds back in a positive health outcome?
Yes, we think so. We know that there's a strong relationship between intensity of activity, and that would mean also intensity of walking, which would be related to the speed, and the health benefits that you get from it. So if you spend 20 minutes strolling, you're not getting nearly as much out of those 20 minutes as you are if you're walking intensely.
Dr. Small, I'm sorry, Eleanor, but Dr. Small in L.A., does that say to you that the pace of life in cities, which I think has long been seen as a kind of by many as a potential menace, could actually be a net plus?
You know, I think it is, because particularly when you look at physical conditioning, to get the aerobic or cardiovascular benefit, you need to pace yourself a bit. You can't just take a leisurely stroll, and you see that in New York. But, you know, I think what's interesting about this conversation is that we're learning, hey, we can legislate health. We can tax cigarettes, we can ban trans fats, and we see effects. And that will have a greater impact in a urbanized environment than in a rural environment. But I think we also run the risk of getting into urban rivalry. And rather than, and to that note, by the way, Clive, I think that the health food craze started in Los Angeles, not in New York.
Yeah, no. I'm sure you're right. And yeah, there's another point here that Dr. Simoncic pointed out that is very true, which is that, like, you know, a city can be can actually make it really hard to do certain types of exercise, particularly if it's dangerous. And this is one of the things that's really interesting about, again, how a bunch of almost things happened alchemically at the same time in New York. I mean, technically speaking, New York was a pretty good walking city in the 70s, too, but a lot of people weren't doing a lot of walking because it was incredibly dangerous, you know?
Clive Thompson is with us. He's with New York Magazine, writes for Wired as well. Big piece this week in the magazine, Why New Yorkers Last Longer, and it's not just New York City. Gary Small joins us from Los Angeles. He's director of the UCLA Center on Aging there, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA. And Eleanor Simoncic joins us from Baltimore. She's an epidemiologist at the National Institute on Aging, also teaches at Johns Hopkins. Right now, Christopher's calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call, Tom. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I just want to make a quick comment. I grew up in a city called Edmonton, Canada, in the west.
Sure.
And for the longest time, we had a lot of urban sprawl, but now we're getting a lot of vertical development in the city core, and I'm noticing that that's creating a huge increase in park usage and healthy living styles out that way. And I also noticed the exact same thing in New York City, where the parks and the walking trails are so close to where everybody lives. So I think vertical living is definitely the way to go. It helps people out a lot.
Bring on the density, and up goes the Stairmaster of life. Christopher, thanks for that. Let's go to Susan in Columbia, South Carolina. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
The point I wanted to make is a little bit different, and it has to do more with, I think, a difference in acceptable body image between cities and rural and some suburban areas. I recently moved to the rural South. Grew up in Philadelphia and lived in Los Angeles, and I think in the cities there's a much more cosmopolitan acceptable body image. I've seen since I moved to the South that it's much more acceptable, especially for young people, to have a level of overweight that would just be seen as a negative in cities.
So there's a cultural piece here, too. Clive Thompson points out that there's diversity of a standard image even within a city, but nationally, certainly. Eleanor Simoncic, you looked at Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Memphis. What do you think of Susan's observation?
Well, I think there's a lot to it. We find, particularly when we compare Pittsburgh and Memphis and getting back to walking, is that the normal walking speed in Memphis is much slower than it is in Pittsburgh. And this is within the rural, the urban areas as well as the exurban areas.
So which comes first, the standard, you know, body weight, body image, or the speed of walking? Chicken and egg, where does it begin?
That's hard to say. I think when we examine younger people, I think the sense is that there's volition in terms of activity. There's no actual limitation, so people are making choices about what they do and what they eat. And so it would, in my opinion, it would seem like that the thing that comes first is the lack of activity or the slowness. Or just general sedentary behavior, which also I think is a cultural aspect of this process.
Gary Small, looking at it nationally, how do you see this issue of expectation and, you know, sort of cultural expectation around body image in particular?
Well, I think it's tremendously important, and I think that it drives some of it. But there are so many factors. You know, for example, in New York, you know, there's a kind of a survival of the fittest mechanism that goes on in New York. You're going to get ahead. You're going to make it to the subway station. You're going to go down the stairs faster. You're going to catch the bus.
Go.
It's driven to get ahead. You got to be quick. In a suburb, you know, you got to put your foot on the gas. You got to turn the key in the car. So you don't have those kinds of reinforcers to get people to live healthier. But I think there's a related aspect to this body image issue, and that is, you know, the kind of psychological mindset of places. And there is something, even though I'm an Angeleno, I will admit, there's something about New Yorkers. There's this kind of attitude that is kind of interesting, and I think probably psychologically protective, that they tend to roll things off. They don't take them so seriously, and I think there's a bit of an edge that probably helps them.
Maybe a kind of defense even to health there. Let's go to Lansing, Michigan, and Lisa. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm enjoying this conversation immensely.
Oh, good.
Because I see the boomers, and I see what's happening. But first and foremost, you need a destination. You need a place to walk to, okay?
Yeah.
And living in Lansing, I'm an aerobic person. I enjoy walking. But everything is so difficult to get to that you don't have destination spots. And that's where the New Yorkers have the advantage.
So not just a destination, but one within walking distance that will get you out the door.
And when you're walking and you're heading towards the location, to the market or to whatever the area that you happen to be, the cultural events and whatnot, you're not even aware of the activity that you're involved in because you're engrossed upon getting to a destination.
It's a great point. The steps just fly by.
Absolutely. I enjoy walking, but when you walk in my town, people think there's something wrong with you because you're kind of on a main thoroughfare,
right,
and people stop and ask you if you need a lift.
What's the matter with you, lady? Clive, you know, Lisa raises a point that you speak to directly. It's a kind of a more subtle point here, but that studies that find that actually even the architecture of an environment may play a real role in how much people move around in that environment.
Yeah, sure. There was a really fascinating study that was done looking at the amount of walking done by people based on controlled for the age of their environment. And people, they sort of drew an they drew a line at 1973, probably had some density moment there, inflection point. But they found that people, you know, that lived in environments built before 1973 walked a lot more. Presumably, the theory was because they've got prettier environments to look at and they're more densely built, so there's places to walk too.
So if it's an endless landscape of cookie cutter houses, yeah, let's say, there's not as much draw to go out. You're not going to be stimulated walking by whatever it may be, the Empire State Building or the Public Library or, you know, the Plaza Hotel with their grand facade.
Well, yeah, sure. And I mean, and the point that your caller made is absolutely true, which is that, I mean, I don't do any formal exercise at all myself. But the amount of walking, just running around I do, it's just getting errands done, you know. And so I try going on a treadmill. I get so bored. It's, you know, I'm impressed by people that can do it. But, you know, I don't think about all those miles I'm going because I'm like, well, I'm going to go, you know, to the store. I'm going to go to the bar and meet a friend, or I'm going to go take my son to the park and stuff like that. So it sort of flies by.
Gary Small, does that put L.A. at a disadvantage? You do have to drive to a lot of places in L.A. Your great new museum up on the hill there, I don't think very many people walk to it.
It is a challenge for us. And, you know, you look at these sprawling malls in these suburban areas, it's not inviting. It doesn't motivate you to walk. So I think we have to make an extra effort. Clive, what I'd suggest is get on the treadmill and turn on the news so that you can adjust to these things. You can stimulate your mind. Although it tends to be artificial, you have to make an extra effort to do it.
Let's go to Betty in Framingham, Massachusetts. Betty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for my call.
Sure.
I wanted to speak to what actually Clive started with, and you used the term scourge, and wanted to ask him if he'd speak a little bit to, I'm a social researcher, and I'm wondering about whether the crime and those with AIDS and some of the quote-unquote scourges of society were removed from New York, and that actually helped the numbers because there was a period of time in New York City where that really was a social attempt. So I'll take my answer off there.
Well, and if I may just push that even another notch there, Clive, I mean, what about the poor themselves? You know, sure. Betty raises issues that may be associated with poverty in the sort of golden 90s and beyond. Who knows what it's doing today on Wall Street? But, you know, are these numbers really an effect of a whole lot of wealthy people moving into the city, maybe displacing the poor?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. No one that I was able to find has done any good studies yet, looking at just the displacement effect, i.e. Manhattan has sort of just become this petting zoo for the wealthy now. You can barely afford to take a walk down the block unless you have, you know, like a serious income. So the possibility is that this is just sort of like a numbers cleansing thing. You chase all the poor people that can't afford decent health care or decent food out of New York City, well, you know, the problem solved, right? And there's no doubt there's probably some truth to that, although I couldn't find any solid numbers on it. The one thing that is interesting about the scourges is that, I mean, this was the puzzle, was that your caller is right. There was a lot of these scourges. You got rid of them, you improved the numbers dramatically, but the numbers kept on going up even after the scourges are gone. Like, you know,
you mean the life expectancy number?
Yeah, the life expectancy kept on going up. It went up like 5 months in 1 year, which is a statistical, like, enormous anomaly, and it just did that 2 years ago, right? So something is still happening. I mean, one of the things that's interesting, you talk about scourges, one of the things that I wonder is when you consider all the unhealthy things that are going on in the city, we still have really bad air, you know, we still have like high levels of stress. Boy, if you get rid of those, you'd see some even bigger improvement, you know?
Yeah, of course, Gary Small, I mean, I'm tempted to look across the urban landscape, and it's not all glossy, high-end Manhattan. I mean, we've all seen Newark in the news recently, the killings in Oakland and New Orleans and its problems. We got plenty of cities with industrial waste and bad air and chemical problems and crime still rolling too high.
You know, these are complex issues. I mean, we tend to oversimplify them, but it helps us understand the different factors that are contributing. I mean, we know, for example, there have been studies in Japan that find that the closer you are to a park or to a greenery, the longer your life expectancy, and sometimes the effect can be up to years. At the same time, we know that if you crowd people together, it's going to be more stressful. Crime is not only stressful, but it can kill you. So I think rather than looking for one explanation, what we ought, and suffering from urban rivalry, what we ought to do is learn from the lessons of New York and see what we can take from that so that both urban and rural areas around the country can benefit.
Clive, you looked at the research of Ming Wen. She's a sociologist at the University of Utah. She looked at Chicago on this issue of poverty and gentrification and wealth mixed up together. What did she find?
Well, that was really interesting because, the traditional argument amongst a lot of urban theorists is that, poverty is bad, for health. Mm-hmm. Massive disparities in income are bad. Having like the vast majority of people with almost no money and a tiny elite with all the money, that tends to be bad too. So the theory is if both those things are bad and you put them together, it's going to be even worse. And she was sort of testing that hypothesis, because that's generally what most people would sort of assume in urban theory. And she found that it's actually not necessarily true, because when she looked at the health outcomes of people in kind of neighborhoods that had been gentrified a little bit, i.e. there were very wealthy people living alongside working class and poor people, that the health outcomes for the working class and poor people were much higher than if they were living in an entirely poor neighborhood, right?
Even though they weren't wealthy themselves.
Even though they weren't wealthy themselves.
How does she explain that?
Well, she says it's probably because, you know, rich people tend to, you know, they got a lot of power. And so they agitate locally for, okay, we want the streets cleaned up. You know, we want it to be safe to walk around.
The environment gets improved.
The environment gets improved. We want better health care. Now, here's the interesting thing. You do not see this trickle-down effect when entire populations are walled off from one another. Like when all the rich people are off in this enclave and all the poor people are off here, you do not get any. When it's completely ghettoized, rich ghetto and poor ghetto, you don't see that effect. It's only when they're linked together. So that becomes an interesting urban planning question. You know, how is there any way, you know, you can assist in the design or maintenance of a city so you don't get these extremes? And, you know, one of the complaints people have of Manhattan these days is that it's so expensive to live that it really is just becoming a rich ghetto. There are things that mitigate it a little bit, like rent control is this uniquely New York phenomenon where you have a significant, I mean, it's a double-digit percentage of the apartments in New York, you know, have really, really cheap rent because this legislation was put in place decades ago.
If I've got this right, Gary Small, your wife's grandmother had a rent-controlled apartment on the Upper West Side, lived to be 100.
Still had that apartment. It was so lovely. She had an apartment at Columbus and 70th.
Yeah.
She lived to be 104.
Wow. Well, you know, my grandmother-in-law is in her mid-90s, and she's going strong. It's she lives in 23rd and 8th Avenue.
Those kind of older people, they have the quintessential healthy lifestyle. They have no elevator, so they're up and down the stairs.
Yeah.
They stick their head out the window. They've got a whole social network there. It's tremendous.
Let's get a suburbs defender from Buffalo, New York. Ruth, you're on the air.
Hi. I was thinking about the food, and they commented on the more variety in New York City. Well, in Western New York, in fact, they're now in more states, we have this fabulous grocery store, Wegmans. And I remember going to see my stepdaughter in New York City and looking at the fruits and the vegetables and thinking, these look really awful because we get really fresh produce. They buy from the local farmers and they get deliveries throughout the day.
Ruth, our time is short, but we take your point. You've seen puny, miserable vegetables in New York, and your Wegmans does better. I mean, this is not a universal picture you're describing here, Clive. It's clearly
textured. Also, let me raise one last excellent point that was put forward by an economist named Matthew Turner. He thought that all this talk of the urban health advantage was just sort of red state, blue state snobbery, like, you know, all the sort of skinny rich people in these cities, like looking down on the depravities of the obese suburbs,
and so
he said, well, let's take a look at what's really happening here. If it's true that cities keep you healthier, then we should see that when someone lives in a city and then moves to an exurb or suburb, their health should go down. Their weight should go up, for example. And his study, he looked at people over like a few years period and found that they didn't change weight. People that lived in cities and moved to the suburbs over the next couple of years didn't gain any weight.
What's
vice
it mean?
Versa. Well, his argument is that it's self-selecting. The reason why people in New York live longer is because they get more exercise and stuff. But what that means is that people that like to exercise and like to walk a lot move to New York. You know, it isn't like his argument. New York is not a magic panacea. It's a magnet. It attracts the healthy people, and vice versa. People that move to the exurbs, the suburbs, move there because they want to be able to drive everywhere, because they don't want to have to walk.
Well,
and so you get these self-selecting populations.
Well, whatever it means the cities are no longer exactly those dark, satanic mills. Something's going on here, and it's really fascinating. We're grateful to all of you for helping us look at it. Eleanor Simoncic, joining us from Baltimore today at the National Institute on Aging. Eleanor, thanks for teaching us about how pace and speed matter when we're walking. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Gary Small, author of the Longevity Bible, director of the UCLA Center on Aging. Great to have you from L.A., Gary. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Clive Thompson, a fascinating look in New York Magazine. Please come again. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Listeners, great to have you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Keep walking. This is On Point.
Thank you.